You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello, and welcome to episode 51 of Tea Break Archaeology. I am Matilda Siebrecht, and today I am savouring a vanilla chai tea, and I feel a little bit like a sort of kitchen witch because I actually combined a vanilla black tea and a fancy like chai spice mix to create the tea myself. So I'm basically like an apothecary now. Anyway, joining me on my tea break today, back again, because I have had her on this show before, I have had her on my other podcast and my trowel several times, is Jessica Vendome, object conservator, osteoarchaeologist, and for the purposes of this particular episode, an expert knitter. So welcome back, Jess.
Hi, thank you for having me again. This is so exciting.
You just, you know, you're one of those wonderful guests who's just so multi-purpose that it's like, oh, we need someone to talk about this. How about Jess?
I'll become an expert in that. That's fine. That's easy. Yeah. Give me a week. We'll be fine. Right.
And so are you joining us for tea?
I am. I'm having a traditional builder's cup, as I've been led to believe. So, you know,
black, PG black tips. With milk. Oh, even PG tips, like proper builders.
Yeah, with sugar and milk. Because,
oh, excellent. Okay.
Yeah.
Are you a white sugar or a brown sugar or those little sugar cube things?
I mean, a lot of people do. It's like more like a raw sugar. So it's like not quite a brown sugar, but it's okay. It's not like the bleached kind of white sugar.
Yeah. Yeah. Because here they have these like sugar crystals. They're like mini rocks, basically. Oh, and you'll just put like one in your cup.
Like Demerara. Or something.
No, not even. Like they're big. They're like the size of my thumbnail.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like a proper little. Nice. It looks like a little stone, like a tiny little stone, but it's like a thing of sugar. And you put it in and it just kind of dissolves slowly as you drink, which is very interesting. But I'd never come across them before. I don't know if this is just a German thing or if everyone else in like Western Europe is now listening in and going, yeah, duh. Like,
what are you talking about? Of course,
who doesn't have them. Have them.
But, America, I can tell you right now, America. Oh, there you does go. Not
well,
things,
there you so. Go. Then, you know what I recently discovered? So, I recently had a very popular video on Instagram, which was slightly crazy. And during that, I videoed myself with my little kettle that I put on the stove. I have like one of those kettles that you put down on the stove. And little did I know that would cause the most controversy in the comments section. Everyone's like, why don't you have an electric kettle if you're British? I thought that all British people had electric kettles. So what is it in the US? Do you have electric kettles or do you mainly do stove kettles? Or do you, I've seen videos of people putting cups of tea in the microwave, which is just
very few people are in the death penalty, but microwaving tea is one of them.
I mean, reheating tea, that's one thing.
That's fine. But that's fine.
Heating the water in a microwave to then put the tea, I don't, oh gosh.
Oh, unacceptable. Blacklisted, in my opinion. So because me and my mom are big tea drinkers, we have an electric kettle. Originally, we had a stovetop kettle and then electric kettles came out. And so we were like, oh, this is great. This is
so
fun.
Stove kettles are more common in the US.
I don't know in other households, if I'm honest.
This is, I feel you need to conduct an anthropological study on my behalf, Jess.
We do, yes. Yes, this could be my dissertation. I've been bored recently and thinking about another degree, so what should it be?
How many do you have now?
I have a bachelor's and two masters. So, you know, just a few. Not as good as you. You have more. But
at least mine are just one trajectory. Yours is just like, I want to try this now.
I'm bored. What's next? I'm going to an Egyptology conference in a few weeks. And I'm like, oh, is that another one? Is that the next?
I mean, you're basically an Egyptologist already. You've done a lot of things. You've read all, you introduced me to the Amelia Peabody books. I mean,
oh, they're so good. I'm trying to get my nephew to read them. So I have to send him one.
They're so good. Yeah. We're doing a read-along of them at the moment on the Archaeo Book Club, and it's great fun to reread them.
Oh my god, how did I miss that?
Yeah, oh gosh, join. Why are you not in the Archaeo Book Club, actually?
I don't know.
Oh, anyway.
I follow it on Instagram, and then sometimes I weigh in on Instagram, and then
yes,
I immediately
you
lose any attention span, and so then it just goes away.
Anyway, sorry, listeners, we're a little bit. This is just Jess and I catching up now. It's been a while since we had a chat, but nice to chat to you again. So indeed, Jess has been on before to talk, as we have alluded to, about one of her many passions. So we talked a little bit about object conservation. We talked a little bit about osteoarchaeology, about mummy cases in one of them, talking about the mummy, which was
before we get too far. Matilda, did you hear that the 1999 classic, The Mummy, is getting
it's coming out again.
I know. I'm so excited.
Yeah, well, yes, definitely. Okay. Well, it's only in 2028, though, so.
I know. It's very far away.
We'll have to hold that podcast. Yeah, right? Don't worry. We're going to do an extra special episode. Jess will definitely be featured again, and we'll do a re-record of our episode where we looked at The Mummy. And all
well, maybe we should do like a rewatch of all the mummies, and then can do like a review.
Oh, no. I feel like that meme, you know, oh, no.
Yeah. Well, not the one with Tom Cruise. I refuse to watch that one.
That's not a...
I think I have watched it, but it
I have watched that. It's not corny enough and not like... It needs to have the full, like, proper sense of...
cast.
Rollicking adventure. Like,
you, exactly. You I need Brendan and I need Rachel. And that's...
Yeah, I'm amazed that they come. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's very exciting. Good.
Just so, to pull it up again.
What are we here to talk about? Right.
I don't knitting. Know. I think it was knitting, but...
This is an archaeology podcast. We are professional archaeologists or osteoarchaeologists or conservators or Egyptologists or whatever Jess decides to special in next. Or journalists. There we go. So, yes. And this is a professional archaeology podcast. We're very professional here. And we're going to talk about knitting because that's what professional archaeologists do. Because knitting is one of those things that I feel like has had a bit of a resurgence. And we're going to come back to that. Probably in the next episode, we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But yeah, Jess, one of the things that intrigued me about her was her amazing ability to knit. So, I mean, since when have you been a knitter?
So I went to a Waldorf school, or if you're in Europe, a Steiner school. So it was part of the curriculum. So I learned in first grade. So I was six.
Okay. Those are the ones where it's sort of more activity-based learning or something like that?
It's like interdisciplinary, high concentrations of like art and like outdoor play is part of the whole thing, which is a big deal in at least the American school systems, which basically in kindergarten you start an academic trajectory, whereas in kindergarten I was playing with the gnomes and the fairies in the woods. So perfect. I had a great time.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So knitting was definitely very early then.
Yes. Yeah. Most people who meet me are like, oh, so like you started a few years ago. And I was like, nope, it was 28 years ago. And they're like, I'm sorry, how old are you? 34 for context, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And what has kept it going? Because I mean, I learned lots of different things when I was little, but I haven't necessarily progressed with them to the level that you are at with knitting. So what was it about knitting that kind of, that draws you to it?
Well, I mean, so I was one of like there was a few of us in my class who very like quickly picked up knitting and just sort of kept going with it or challenged themselves to learn something new that wasn't actually taught. Like I knit continental, which is very typical in Europe, but not in America and the UK. They knit English, which is like how you hold the yarn.
Oh my goodness. Sorry, my mind has just been blown. Okay.
I know. You can hold the yarn differently, Matilda. This could help you.
This might help.
So Matilda just told me that she learned how to crochet recently.
I did.
And I'm very excited about this. But the way that you hold yarn for a crochet is kind of the way you hold yarn for continental knitting. Whereas English knitting, you throw the yarn with your right hand. And so I learned to throw when I was little. And then I watched my knitting teacher knit continental. And I was like, what's that? How do I do that? She's like, I won't teach you this. And I was like, cool, I will stare at you for an hour and I will figure it out. And I did.
I mean, that's a perfect analogy for like the skill acquisition in archaeological interpretation. Like when people are like, but how were they taught? It's like they literally just watched and they learned. So there you go. No, we've fitted some archaeology in here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we'll have some more. It'll be okay.
Don't worry, I'm not complaining. But okay, so you learned the different styles.
I learned the different styles. And then, you know, there'd be holidays or birthdays. And I'm like, oh, I should just knit them a hat. Oh, I can just knit them a whatever. And at the time, you know, in the, you know, first in the 90s, then the early 2000s, there weren't a lot of resources for like patterns. So you just sort of made things up as you went. Huh. But it wasn't very complicated. I mean, you could buy patterns, like printed patterns, obviously, but those were hard to find. Or you would find some and go, oh my God, these are from the 80s. I don't want to make these. Ew.
Whereas nowadays, you'd be like, whoa, these are from the 80s. How cool.
Oh my God, these are vintage. This is great. Although some of the older patterns are hard to follow. I knit one from the 40s and I was like, oh God, why did you do that? That's stupid. That's a dumb thing to do. I'm going to change it. So yeah. And then with like advancements in technology and stuff like that, a site called Ravelry was created, which I highly recommend for any crafters. Mm-hmm. It's a free online sort of resource for you to like look for patterns and get tips, and you know, people can share their progress on different things. And it's not the most well updated site, I'll be honest, but there are a lot of tricks to it that like you can pick up and like refine your searches and stuff like that. And so that made finding more interesting patterns more available. So then it was like, oh, I can make this cute sweater and that'll be fun. And then I can wear it. This is great. And so then by the time I got to Leiden University, it became sort of like a, it was just like a relaxing thing to do. It was just to sit and knit, which is great. Really nice. And so it's just continued as a, you know,
mindfulness exercise.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things, one of the reasons why I wanted to start it, because I was really into sewing and all those kinds of things. And I used to sew a lot by hand. And then I got a sewing machine and then I started using that a lot more. But sometimes you don't want to sort of necessarily sit at the sewing machine and have the and it's like in a very specific place and all this kind of thing. So I used to go back to sewing by hand a lot, but then that's sort of, you have to have all the pieces that you cut out and, you know, keep checking and measuring and all sorts of stuff. So I thought, let's try knitting. But it just wasn't relaxing for me because I get so frustrated with all of these different things. But I mean, do you find that it's, I mean, we've already mentioned crochet. There's obviously like needle binding. There's all sorts of different similar kind of textile crafts, I guess, textile related crafts. How do you find like that knitting compares for you to the kind of other crafts, similar crafts?
So for me, because, well, so technically I learned to sew and embroider when I was in kindergarten. So I was like 4 or 5. That should be the more relaxing of them, but you have to really keep your eyes on the fabric, which is just annoying. But because I've been knitting for so long, if the pattern is like memorizable or easy enough or whatever, I don't really need to look at my knitting while I do it.
Crazy.
Yeah. I joke that I have like Yeah, exactly. When we lose power out here in New England, it comes in handy because then I don't need too much light. But I joke about, you know, my different projects have different purposes. So I have my like, oh, I'm watching, like me and my mom watch Chinese historical dramas. And so like I have my Chinese historical drama and those subtitles go by faster. So I have to look at the screen more so I can't be looking at what I'm knitting. And then there's like the Korean drama projects. Those I can look at a little bit more because the subtitles don't go by as fast. I'm also trying to learn Korean, so you know, it's all part of the process. And then I have my like, oh, I have to look at this like all the time kind of project. And so usually I save those for like an audiobook or something like that.
Nice. I like that.
So then with like for other crafts, like I'm not a particularly good crocheter. I can crochet.
But
it's just not as automatic for me. And I haven't tried like knoll binding, like the needle weaving.
Yeah.
Which is, I've seen it, but it's.
And would you say that, because one of the main reasons I got into crochet, I must admit, is because I was talking to someone about it and they suggested crochet is kind of one of those ones that it's easier to pick up and then takes longer to really kind of master and become sort of do more complex stuff, but it's easier to pick up and just go than knitting is. Would you agree with that?
I think it depends on. It kind of depends on how your brain works, if I'm honest.
Okay.
Because so I can picture knitting. So, and it's all like, it's a grid. So knitting is a grid. So if you work well with like Excel spreadsheets, I think you'd probably be good at knitting. So like a lot of like computer programmers are good with knitting because it's all the same sort of like code structure. Apparently I have been told this.
Oh, interesting.
I am not a programmer.
Disclaimer.
But a lot of my friends, now you included, have found that crochet is easier and more accessible initially.
Yeah.
And it's kind of more flexible. So it's really good for like stuffed animals or things that like you kind of are making up the structure as you go. Whereas knitting, oh my God, my cat's
gone. Is that your cat in the background? It's fine. We can hear you.
If anyone hears weird sounds, it's my cat, Henry. He is a terror. Anyway, so yeah, so crochet is good for like making up shapes and yeah, it has a lot more flexibility than knitting. I mean, you can make knitting do this, but it tends, like crochet is a little bit more structured anyway.
Yeah.
And so yeah.
Yeah.
I think knitting is nice for garments because it has less structure. So it's more comfortable to wear.
That makes sense. Like,
items.
Because indeed, I've been sort of just playing around with like making things with crochet and I haven't been following patterns. But once you sort of know how it works, I find it a lot easier to just kind of play around and be like, oh, okay, so I need to make this row longer so I can add these things. And whereas with knitting, I just would get so confused. And it's like, wait, this has to be in this shape and I don't get it. Like, it doesn't work. So
I have to knit two together. Where? How do I do that?
Exactly. And then you're like, now I have... Why do
three
I have
less stitches?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, okay, let's pick apart the last 16 rows. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, I do hear that a lot. But one of my friends, she's also a conservator. And so she kind of knew how to knit, but then took up crochet. Mm. And now she's been trying to make sweaters in crochet and kind of losing her mind a little bit.
Yeah, because
it's also hard to keep track of like your number of stitches in crochet because you just have to be able to read your fabric.
Yeah.
Whereas in knitting, all of your live stitches are on the needle. So if you have the right or the wrong number, you kind of know.
It's easier to count. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I've got that issue already.
So she's going to try Tunisian crochet, which is sort of a mixture of both.
Okay.
I haven't actually tried it. I think my grandmother used to do it. Jeez. Why she never taught me, I don't know, but here we all are. So then I was like, oh, well, this could be like the gateway drug to knitting. So you can join me in the knitting. Because she's always like, oh, I don't like any of these crochet patterns. And I was like, look at this cute knit one. She was like, dang you.
Yeah.
Come on. So, yes, yeah. I try to bring everyone to knitting. But crochet is an admirable, and I can't read crochet patterns. So I am impressed by anyone who can.
It's different stitches for different... Oh, I won't say it because we're we're a child-friendly podcast.
Stitches for different witches.
Witches. There we go. That's a good one. Different stitches.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. Well, let's take a very quick break to top up our tea and then we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I hope your teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So we've talked a little bit about knitting, about our interests in knitting and crochet and the battles there between. But in terms of archaeologically speaking. Now, I feel like we should start with a bit of a disclaimer, because even though, as we mentioned at the beginning, you have all this specialization and experience in a range of different topics, so you are very knowledgeable about lots of things. You're very knowledgeable about knitting because you've done it for so long, but have you ever actually studied knitting, like, archaeologically?
Until the last week when I was panic researching, I did not. So
I just feel like we should kind of point that out, because you're an archaeologist, or, you know, because you're an anthropologist, archaeologist, people might get confused. But
yes, I mean, I wear a lot of hats. Knitter is one of them. It is not necessarily related to archaeology.
Yeah.
But we have made it connected.
We have. And I think that's what's nice, actually. And I find this a lot, because in a lot of my content that I create as well, I'm not necessarily an expert in the particular object that I'm researching or something like that. But I think it's kind of, you learn the process of researching as well when you're doing like a lot of the degrees and stuff.
Oh yeah. And I like kind of along the same lines of researching is just learning how to talk about things.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I feel like I have the vocabulary the to talk about archaeology.
But of course, we have, in the last two episodes, we had Ronja Lau, who is a textile archaeologist. So the field of research does exist. So remember, anyone listening in who thinks, but I love knitting and I want to do that professionally, you absolutely can. It's completely fine. And I have had people on before who have studied knitting from an archaeological perspective as well. But I thought it would just be fun to chat about it from more of a crafting perspective in this particular case. But in terms of archaeological evidence for knitting, I tried to do a very quick preliminary search and I really struggled to actually find, it seems there's a lot of discussion about what is the earliest and what is, so I mean, do we know, for example, the earliest physical evidence, the earliest written evidence of knitting?
So, well, I mean, not really.
Great.
So,
well, that's all for now, folks. Thanks for listening.
That was it. We don't know. Good luck. Use Google sparingly. No. The short answer is there is early evidence of knitting, and we have objects that illustrate knitting. Mm-hmm. But a big problem is that some of the early things were not excavated by, or like even today, if there is an item excavated and they're like, oh, it's, you know, however many thousands of years old, the people working that site are not themselves necessarily handcrafters. So they're not going, they're just going to say, oh, it's not woven. Mm-hmm. It must be knitted.
Yeah.
But that is just a, you know, like very surface level knowledge of handcraft. And I feel like knitting often gets used as sort of this like umbrella term for it was handmade and it was not woven. And that is very reductive. So a lot of times there's a pair of socks or one sock from like 1080 Egypt, but apparently that was now binding instead of knitting. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then there's some Coptic socks that were also found in Egypt from like 1180. And those are very clearly knitted and they use fairly complicated color work with undyed and indigo dyed cottons. Mm-hmm. And for them to have learned how to do this color work, they would have had to been doing it for a little while. So clearly it's been around, but it's hard to say exactly when it started.
True.
Plus, that's the materials just don't last.
Yeah. Right. Well, and that's no, but indeed, like, you're right. That's the point. It's something you don't think about in like, oh yeah, this is the oldest evidence we have. Therefore they must've been doing it for, you know, a little bit before then. But as we've also been discussing, you know, Jess is very good at knitting because she started when she was born, you know. So I guess this is something that people would have had to work out as well in some way.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it doesn't take a huge amount of time to learn color work, but someone would have had to think about using two different colors and then putting that into the work as opposed to painting it later or dyeing it later or doing something like that. So it is interesting.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's really fascinating. And so that's the kind of earliest physical evidence we have for actually the knitted fragments themselves. Do you know if there's any evidence of like knitting needles?
Well, you are my object in microwave analysis. So you would know this more than I do, but knitting needles have a tendency to look like any other stick or pointed stick. And I think a pointed stick has a lot of functions. Mm-hmm. And so trying to figure out if it's like a knitting sort of tool or if it's not, that's difficult. Whereas like nail binding uses a fairly large needle. So I know you are familiar with a lot of needles.
Yes.
So for different purposes, but that would be easier to identify as like a craft tool versus, I don't know what other, you know, rod, stick.
Painting
stick. A boar child with a, you know.
Yeah, with just a stick. Well, and also, because from the sounds of it, from what you were saying before the break, there's so many different techniques that you can use even in the modern day for knitting. So we have absolutely no idea what kinds of techniques they would have been using, even if they were using two sticks. How would they have been doing the stuff? So even things like microwear, and this is something that I discovered in my research as well with the sewing, is that if you have a different technique of sewing, like whether you push the needle straight through or whether you twist it a bit before it goes through, or whether, like, there's so many different things you can do, all of that will leave different microwear traces. So you can't even do like experimental knitting and then compare the microwear traces that are created from that with ones from this 1080 sock, because if they were using a slightly different technique, it would probably look different like under the microscope. Yeah,
I mean, technically one could recreate this sock and, you know, do the microwave analysis on the needles you used for that sock.
Yeah, but even but if then, you, but what technique would you use to knit? Like, which would you use a modern knitting technique? Would you use the, what did we mention, Tunisian crochet? Would you use continental? Well, would you use like, yeah.
So I would think, well, one, this is an interesting question, is does continental versus English knitting
leave
show
different traces? Jess, I think we need to do a experimental study on this.
Yes, I'm in. Let's go. Let's get the research.
I'm actually serious. I think that's really interesting and we should definitely do that. I'm going to create some bone and wooden needles for you and send them over and you can do some knitting.
Please do.
Actually, we're going to do that. So watch this space, ladies and gentlemen, because that sounds really fun.
Part two is coming. Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And then the other thing that I would think about would be like talking about the color work in these socks that they found, they would have had to get to that place. And are they replacing their needles frequently? Mm-hmm. Also, you know, in Egypt, wood is fairly scarce as a native substance. So it would have to be imported. So who is doing the knitting? How often are they replacing it? Are they using bone? Are they using ivory?
Or copper or something as well, right?
Or copper. Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just like, what is accessible? And are they making other things other than these socks? Because we only have the one sock or the two socks, or I can't.
You think someone just gave up and was like, "Ugh, this sock was so difficult. I can't be bothered to making another one."
I personally hate making socks because you have to make two of them, and knitting two at a time is doable, but you get so tangled. So I hate socks. So I would knit one and go, no, thank
that's
you.
Enough.
I'm done.
Oh, that's like, this is the problem with me now learning crochet. I have two daughters. And if I make one little thing, like I made a little mouse, and one of them was like, oh, can I have it? And I was like, yeah, sure. And then, of course, what does the other one say? But mommy, I want one too. And then you're like, that's fine, I'll make you one as well. And then you're frantically trying to remember how you made it and doing exactly the same. Has to look good enough. It can't be too much smaller, too much bigger. Oh, yeah. Anyway, so I feel the pain.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so in terms of tools, knitting tools, difficult to say. We're going to do the experimental study that will throw this into light, and
we're going to break this subject wide open.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. We got it. You heard it here first, everyone. So,
so you were saying that like it's hard to like find like reputable sources to like what is the oldest objects, what is all this and stuff like that. And what I was finding in my research was the same thing. So it was like knitting yarn shop, like yarn shop blogs or a knitter's blog.
Yes.
And they've clearly done research, but was it just with Wikipedia?
Exactly.
And when you go to Wikipedia, it brings you to these like blog sites. And I'm like, who's telling who what? Like,
also, this isn't like the even the blog sites, and they'll have like a very well thingied article, but they don't have any information page about like who the author is or anything. And then I'm like, but who is this author? Is it someone who's just like kind of interested? And maybe that's still fine, right? Like there's people who are not academically qualified who still are very good researchers and are very intelligent and can obviously, you know, do this research. But you just need to be aware of who's doing it. I had exactly the same thing when I was looking up about the archaeology of notebooks, actually, because there's so many notebook shops. And then they have a blog about the history of the notebook and all this kind of stuff. And then you're reading it going, okay, but where, like you say, that references Wikipedia, which references this blog post. And then you're like,
yeah, this is somehow suspicious.
Yeah.
I would not have this passed in a university course.
Yeah.
As research.
Things like
Google's or like program. Somebody like the V&A, the Victoria and Albert Museum, they have like a history of knitting thing, but it references a lot of the objects that they have, not that exist. And so they're like, this is the earliest one we have. So they have some early Egyptian socks, but I think they're like 1500 AD or something like that. And so it's weird. It's weird. So so we need to break the research. Yes. We're going to be the academic.
There we go.
And crafters.
Do proper scientific method. And it'll be great.
This will be my next degree.
The teacup degree. The teacup university.
Oh my God. Can you start it? Can
fudge around and find out. Yeah. Fake it till you make it.
What does it take, right?
I mean, this is a really cool concept, though, for continuing this podcast, is that the two of us just come up with different experiments that we want to do and discuss why it's important to do those experiments and like what we want to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, there is a woman at Cambridge who's getting her PhD in like handcraft.
Right. I saw that. I saw her. She does really cool studies and really interesting. Yeah. There's all sorts of interesting.
Yeah. She does a podcast with a knitter named Cleavely Knits on Instagram. Well, he's on all the social medias, but they're fantastic. I love them.
Oh, amazing. We'll put, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but we will find her and we will put her in the show notes so that everyone can go and follow her. And
And Cleavely Knits is also a fantastic social media source on the active side of knitting instead of the research side of knitting.
Yeah, but then indeed it's good to have those two sides of things.
Yeah,
which is good, which people should listen in probably. Actually, yes, I think by the time this episode goes out, we're going to have a new show on the Archaeology Podcast Network, which is a show that has existed for quite a while called The Exarch Show, which I was a host of for a long time, so this is how I know about it. And I'm still a host for some of the segments, but yeah, and they're all focused on experimental archaeology and open air museums and all that kind of stuff. So if you're interested in finding out more about kind of experiments and crafting and the intersection between technologies and things like that, do go and check out that show, because it's pretty, pretty good. But, and so we've talked about kind of the earliest physical evidence of knitting, but how about the earliest written references to knitting, like historically?
Yeah, so that's also like a kind of weird, tricky answer, because I think it's the International Knitting Guild Association. They offer a Master's of Knitting, which I did sign up for. I just lost interest, so I haven't done it yet.
Oh.
Anyway, they state that the earliest reference is like, I think it was like 1600 or something, they were talking more about the first knitting pattern, not written record of knitting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But my sort of boiled down answer is that it's sort of Elizabethan England. So the first knitting machine was made in, it was like 1459 or something like that. So pretty early. So then it became an industry as opposed to just like a fun handcraft.
Okay.
And so then people started using it more. Yeah. And it became, knitwear became part of like the daily fashion of like the middle class. So like knit caps and like your classic Shakespearean hose were knit because they had these knitting machines available to them.
Interesting. So, I did not know that knitting machines were that old.
I also did not know that. It was very shocking.
Like, I was thinking like 1950s, but it's like 14.
Yep. Wow. And a lot of the knitting machines that are like existing today, like accessible to all of us, are like from the 1970s. Like, there's like one company that still makes new ones, but for the most part, they're all from the 70s.
That's amazing. Gosh.
Yeah. Well,
interesting. Oh, well.
Yeah. So that's a fun fact for us today.
There you go. Okay. So it's not necessarily talking about kind of knitting itself as a craft before then necessarily. Well, there probably are references, but difficult to find.
Yeah. There's some, I think they're medieval paintings. Mm. I mean, me in history, I have a hard time with time periods. It's either Egypt or it's not. So
that's such an Egyptologist answer, Jeff.
I know.
Sorry, as I was mentioning Egypt, then I have no idea.
I've got nothing. And then it all just is a blank until about World War II. And then blink back in again. Or like Victorian, maybe. I don't know. Anyway. So in about the medieval period, there's quite a number of paintings called the Knitting Madonnas, which are very interesting. And I never really heard of them or even seen them. But they are very clearly painted by people who have seen people knitting before. It's very clearly knitting. Mm-hmm. There's one that I saw that had, I mean, it was something that they were knitting in the round. So they were knitting in the round at this point and had four needles and like a fifth working needle. So for us today, it's a double pointed needle. But yeah, it was really interesting. I was like, oh, they have actually seen knitting, as opposed to all the paintings where they're like, yes, this is a cat. And it is not a cat.
Have you seen those medieval ones where it's like, there's little memes, right? Where it's, are you sure you know what an elephant looks like? Yeah, I totally know what an elephant looks like. And then it looks like a cat with a very big nose or something like that.
Yep, exactly. It's like, oh, so you've seen a horse before. Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Yes. It also looks
they
like a small child.
They have big grins, right?
Yeah.
Smile
How
a
many
lot.
Teeth do they have?
So, yeah, no, I guess that's really interesting. And I mean, have you ever, obviously, from your, so I kind of threw you in the deep end with this episode because I basically said to Jess, hey, Jess, you knit. Do you want to come talk about knitting with me? By the way, you need to find out all of this stuff about knitting. But in terms of your actual areas of academic expertise, shall we say, that you have more experience in, with, for example, conservation, have you ever had to conserve something knitted or some kind of fiber crafts thing?
Well, so fiber crafts, yes. I mean, I tend to lean away from textile conservation because I find that old textiles just don't want to, well, one, they don't want to exist, and two, they misbehave. And so I work on three-dimensional objects, typically organics, but so like wood, and wood does what I expect wood to do, even if it's old.
Right.
Like, it has a behavior, whereas textiles, you're like, oh, I want you to do this. And it's like, no, I don't want to.
Wood's like a dog and textiles like a cat.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And I don't even, I'm not a dog person. I'm a cat person.
Right?
But
yeah.
Somehow textiles, I'm just like, come on, can you just work with me, please? Just do what I need you to do. Don't fall apart. No. So sadly, I haven't actually come across any knit objects that I have to do anything with. The closest that I get is that my local yarn store will take in sweaters from people that have like moth holes or, I don't know, it's ripped or something. And so I do the mending and the repairs for those.
Ah, nice. The darning. Nice. Yes. Which I need to learn how to do, actually, because I have some lovely woolen socks and they've got so many holes in them and I need to fix them. So, that's...
Oh, it's very fun.
Yeah.
Because there's and then we could talk about darning versus repair. And so I do a bit of both. But I repair by matching the stitches that were lost. Ideally with yarn that matches fairly well. And so most people are like, wait, I brought this in for repair. What happened?
What was wrong with it?
There's no hole in it anymore. They're like, yeah, but I can't see it. I'm like, yeah, that's the point.
The point.
Duh, I'm just that good. Come on.
Yeah. but that's like the Visible Stitch Club or whatever it is. I can't remember now what it's called, but there's a really cool, yeah, like account which shows how you can do like fun things and make it visible mending. Visible mending, that's the one.
Yeah. Which I think is very cool. And I did do that for somebody's sweater. They brought in like rainbow colored yarn and then they had this dark gray sweater and they're like, I want this to be as visible as possible. And I was like, you got it.
Which we talked about a bit, I think, on the last episode I had you on in terms of conservation work, right? In terms of like, how much do you make it look like what it used to look like versus make it clear that this is a conservation job, but like it's respecting the original kind of thing.
So exactly. Yeah. It's that like sort of difference between restoration and conservation.
That's right. I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. So like restoration is like kind of bringing it back to as close to new as possible, whereas conservation respects the hands and time it has traversed through while maintaining its structure and stability and things like that. And so with knitwear repairs, I try to go the more conservation route. Actually, with everything, I try to go
there you
the
go. Conservation it's, yeah, route. It's ingrained.
I very rarely have to restore anything. Thank the gods. Trying to make things look new that are not is not fun. They don't want to be new.
But I've lived. I want to show my scars.
But I've lived. I've existed. So in conservation, we use like the 6-6 rule. So 6 inches, you can tell that something was done to it, but from 6 feet, you can't. So like in a gallery space, you're not going to notice the alteration or the repair. But if you're up close and personal with the object, you should be able to see it a little bit.
See it. That's fascinating. Oh, next time I'm in a museum, I'm going to be like pressing myself against the glass, trying to look at all these objects and be like,
exactly. Well, and also as a conservator who has given tours in museums, you can email the conservators and say, hey, is it possible to get a tour of your galleries and show me what you've worked on? I'd love to see what kind of conservation work has been done in this museum. And so they'll take you on a little tour. I did this. And oh, you can see the little paper repair there.
Oh, because that's, I mean, I love that. That's why I love doing like walking tours of cities and stuff as well. Like I did one, I went to York at the end of last year and we did a like ghost walking tour, which I was like, okay, it was really good. Actually, it was very good. The guy who ran it was very funny. Like, and so he was sort of being spooky, but also like funny spooky. But he also showed all these really cute little, you know, like, oh, look, here's a little wooden mouse that's been carved into this door. And that's because the man who carved the door, that was his like signature thing. And so if you look at certain things, you'll know if he's carved them because there'll be a little mouse somewhere, you know, like little things, like you say, that you would never notice if you just walk past. But then once you see it, you're like, oh, that's the.
And I have noticed that ghost tours specifically are really good at pointing out those weird little like things that you would miss normally. Like
maybe because they have to pad the tour out a bit, let's be honest. I mean,
maybe. But I mean, personally, I love a ghost tour. I like that there's like a little spooky, but there's also like, here's all the history. And this is spooky because history is often terrible. And
yeah.
But like, here's a little mouse or, you know, whatever the cute thing is.
Exactly.
Well,
anyway, I think we're running a bit out of time. We've got a bit off piste on this particular tea break. Very interesting conversations, though. Thank you so much. Don't worry, people listening in, there will be another tea break coming up in 2 weeks' time where I will be chatting further with Jess all about the history of knitting. We're going to be talking more about the social history of knitting next time. I very much hope you enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please do like or follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topics of today's episode or about Jess's work and previous episodes that she's been a guest on, you can find all of the links and contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.